Well, good afternoon. Welcome to this gathering together. I thought, came to me this afternoon that maybe I would talk about something that, how can we say? Well, I don't need to describe it. It is what it is. And it's the whole subject of one's personal will. And so much of one's ego structure is actually constructed around sort of around this phenomena of one's personal will. In the life of the ego-driven life, is the whole life is dominated by one's own will, one's own personal will. And if you never really address that personal willfulness, your spirituality, even your realization can only go so far. Because you can actually have a very profound spiritual awakening without really dealing with your personal will at all. And yet, the first thing that a lot of people bump up against, those who have a real glimpse of reality, what they bump up against very quickly is their personal will. It could be their will to hold on to the experience. It could be their will to stay in a particular state. It could be their will to be seen as enlightened. There's a lot of ways that the personal will can survive far beyond a very powerful spiritual realization. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those subjects, you know, that doesn't necessarily fill rooms up, you know, in spirituality. If you put an advertisement up now, the discussion today will be about the eradication of one's personal will. It's not going to, like, fill auditoriums, I don't imagine. How to manifest $1 million, get your soulmate and be rich and at the same time be spiritual will fill rooms everywhere. Right? But this whole notion of personal will is really, it becomes really vital at a certain point. And as I say, one's whole ego structure is often constructed around personal will. You know, someone like the Buddha used to call it attachment and aversion, and everybody knows attachment and aversion, or everybody thinks they know what attachment and aversion is. But attachment and aversion are actually just an extension of one's personal will. I want this, I don't want that. That's will, right? I will towards this, and I don't want that to happen. I want or I will the world to be a particular way, usually a way that it's not. Right? Because if it was already that way, then you wouldn't have to will it, would you? You wouldn't have to want it to be that way. I want or I will to be understood, to be liked, to be approved of, to be rich, even to be enlightened. I want to be enlightened. It's even that has a certain element of one's personal will. Mm-hmm. And really freedom is, in many ways, it's really freedom from personal will. Which is ironic because a lot of people have the whole notion of enlightenment. It's very much defined by their personal will. Their idea of it is totally defined by what they want it to be. Do you know, does that make sense? So in other words, when that's the case, we're chasing a preconceived idea of what we think spiritual freedom is. And that idea is always an idea that's good for you. Have you ever noticed? Like most people's, like, when I'm enlightened, it always has some version of it'll be really good for me. It'll be better for me. I'll be happier and, I don't know, everybody has their own idea, I suppose. Do you know? But this whole notion of personal will is something, like I said, it doesn't necessarily fill rooms up because it's not a good sales pitch for enlightenment. Do you know? Enlightenment, if it, in many ways, it's defined through the lack of personal will, the transcending of one's personal will. It's the freedom from your personal will. It's the freedom from wanting and not wanting. Now, most people don't think of happiness and freedom. Most people think of happiness and freedom in terms of that I will get what I want. Whether it's materialistic, whether it's spiritual, whether it's, you know, in whatever realm they're in, it's some version of I'll be happy when I get what I want, right? So if you're a child, you'll be happy when you get, you know, your toy fire engine for Christmas, or whatever it is you want. I'll be happy then. And I won't be totally happy until I get that damn fire engine for Christmas. See what I mean? As an adult, I'll be happy when, I don't know. If you're young, probably when I get out of college, won't that be great, you know? I'll be happy when I'm independently wealthy. When this will toward this self-willfulness gets into spirituality, then it defines its personal will, its object of desire, through I'll be happy when my spiritual will is fulfilled, right? When I am free, when I am enlightened, when I'm in union with God, when I'm all that. Which is ironic because the reality of spiritual awakening is not that has nothing to do with the fulfillment of that kind of will, that wanting. It's the freedom from that kind of wanting, do you see? Which is very, very, very different. It's a freedom. It's not the acquisition of anything you want. It's no longer wanting. That's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Or so you think. Yeah. So there's... And this plays out on many, 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 many different levels. There's very obvious ego wanting, attachment, grasping, and pushing away, which I just mentioned some of that. There's spiritual grabbing and pushing away, what you hope spirituality is all about, what you imagine it's all about. Then there's a deeper sort of will that operates in the realm, you might even say, keeps operating almost in the realm of spirit. It's sort of a spiritual wanting that people often bump into when they've had some realization. Because realization itself can engender a whole new type of wanting. I want to stay in that awakened place all the time. I want to feel as good as I felt on that day when the veils parted and I saw what I was, what reality was for the very first time. I want to live in that state of ecstasy forever. That's what I want. So this will can continue in the realms of spirit, and in many more subtle ways than I'm even mentioning. You see, and if that's the case, then you come to a teacher like me and you say, "I had this wonderful moment, you know, in 1974 at 3:30 a.m. in the morning, when I got woken up by a rooster in the neighbor's backyard, and I looked out at the moon, and I had this huge, overwhelming aha experience. And dear teacher, can you tell me how to get that back and how to have it always?" See, right at that point, if the teacher is worth their salt, what they know that they're talking to is a personal will. That's what's asking the question. And if they were to be answered in an honest way, the answer would be, "I'm afraid there's no hope for you." Do you know? You will not get what you want in the spiritual realm any more than you got what you wanted at any other point in time. And in fact, when you got what you wanted, you were never happy anyway. Think of all the times that you thought in your life. Everybody remembers the times when they didn't get what they wanted, right? Everybody, I didn't get this, and I didn't get this, and I didn't get this, and I asked for this for Christmas, and damn it, I didn't get it. But everybody forgets of all the things they've gotten in life that they wanted. I mean, right down to the smallest things. You know, I don't know, you wanted a particular teacup, and you got it, or... You know, you wanted a big screen TV and you got it, or you wanted a beautiful car or a nice house or whatever it was. And think of all the things you've wanted. And you only wanted them because you thought they would make you happy. You don't want things that you think won't make you happy, right? I want to be miserable. Nobody really consciously wants to be miserable, I don't think. Maybe unconsciously, but... And yet, so everybody in this room has received many, many things that you thought would make you happy, haven't we? Does happiness actually work that way? Of course you're happy for a moment. But do they actually make you happy? Think of the thousands, not even 10 or 20 or 100, but literally the thousands of things we've all gotten that we wanted. I'm sure there's many things you didn't. That you still want, that you don't have. But all the things you do, all the things that you were thought would make you happier, and then you got it, and it didn't really make you happier except for a moment, you know? It's kind of like caffeine. Gives you a temporary high, and then a dip, do you know? I want again. What do you want? I want to be high again. Oh, okay. So then you have to get the next thing, right? Then you're down at, like, Target again, right? Or the dollar store. Right? Those dollar stores, those are great for wanters, because you don't even have to spend, you know, right? If I find just the right thing at the dollar store, I'll be happy. You've done it. You know what I mean. The amazing thing is we can continue to do this literally for a whole lifetime, even though our experience keeps showing us that, you know, the acquisition of something that we wanted, while it has a temporary, momentary blip of happiness, of satisfaction, while you got the hot little thing in your hands, actually it doesn't bring happiness. But how many of us want to actually see that? We experience it. We've all experienced it thousands of times, haven't we? Especially in this culture, especially with the people sitting in this room. And I don't mean to suggest that everybody in this room is tremendously well off. You may have struggled a lot in your life, but you've still gotten a tremendous number of things that you wanted, all of which you thought you'd be happier with. And so even though they don't really make us happy ultimately, it's amazing how we continue in the same cycle, is it not? Because we don't really want to see that they don't make us happy. We know that, but we don't really want to know it. You know, the most important things that we all know are things that we desperately don't want to know. The most important things that you come to know are the things that you really don't want to know. So nobody wants to know that everything that they think is going to make them happy isn't really going to, it's not going to work out. It's not going to work out. It never has. And then nothing's going to change. It never will, right? That doesn't mean you'll never be happy. It just means the things in your life won't make you happy. But we don't want to look at that. Why? Because it leaves us feeling like, because then you feel the temporary, you just touch upon for a moment the futility of the personal will. And when many people, when they touch upon the futility of their personal will, they go into sort of a tailspin. They get very despondent. Oh, nothing Nothing I acquire is going to make me happy. Oh my God. That's awful. What's going to make me happy? You know? Well, maybe things won't make me happy. That won't work. Spiritual experiences will. Right? So I'll meditate, and I'll get into this very nice meditative state, into this groove, very peace, very calm, very nice state. You know, not very often, but once in a while. You see? Most of the time you'll be meditating and you'll just be wondering what time it is. But every once in a while, something wonderful will happen. And after it happens, a momentary taste of peace happens. You'll find yourself down at the bookstore buying the book that says How to Integrate Spirituality into Your Everyday Life. That'll be the title or something like that. And you'll buy it because you had this moment, you see. You've had these nice moments on your meditation cushion or you're chanting to God or whatever you're doing. And you want to know how to bring that out of that moment into every time. Isn't that right? You see what I'm right? Personal will. The personal will always thinks, I'll be happy when. Not now, but when. When something changes, I'll be happy. When I get what I want, or I get rid of this thing or person or event that I don't want, then I'll be happy. So personal will is always looking for satisfaction sometime other than now. Now is the absolute enemy of your personal will. Because your personal will only functions in time. If such and such didn't happen, then I would be happy now. And if I get such and such in the future, then I'll be happy. You notice the thing that's left out is right now. Right? Always left out right now. It has nothing to do with right now. Because right now is the cessation of that thirst. So, even to talk about this, first of all, this isn't proprietary information. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. Everybody's experienced what I'm talking about. You might not want to know what you know, but everybody knows. Everybody knows that, you know, the next thing you acquire isn't going to bring you lasting happiness. At best, it's going to be like a shot of coffee or, a temporary lift. Everybody knows that, but not many people actually want to know it. So this isn't hidden spiritual information. This isn't really, this part of it isn't very, very deep spiritual teaching. It's kind of obvious. But we often have the greatest resistance to the most obvious things. And as I said, even when you've had a great or some scene of reality, this personal will rarely just give up that easy. It will want more. Who can I be with this? Who can I become now? Now that I've had some moment of realization. I can't tell you how many people over the years who, within days or weeks or a month or two of having some spiritual awakening, they come to me and announce that they are ready to teach. And I always think, oh, I'm very, very sorry for you. This is And I understand it, you know, it's often very, very innocent, you know, but a lot of time underneath it is this very transparent personal will. Like, oh, now this is what I can become. Now I can become a teacher, or I can go save the world, or now I can do something. You see what I mean? And but it's exuberant now because now it's powered by a very powerful, positive experience. Right? So it has a lot of fuel. Right. So what's it mean? The falling away of one's personal will, because I can guarantee you that that is what liberation is all about. That's what it's about. So if you want to have your desire for what you think spirituality is about fulfilled, leave. Don't stay here. Don't be involved in deep spirituality. Go somewhere where they don't really want the deeper forms of spirituality. And I'm not joking either. You see, because when this thing catches you, and then it's too late at a certain point. It really is too late. And some of you in this room know what I'm talking about, right? That experience of you chasing God or nirvana or whatever, you're chasing God, and then all of a sudden one day you realize God's chasing you. And you realize that your idea of what enlightenment was actually means nothing to the God who's chasing you. And yet it's no longer your choice. You can't bow out of the deal. Do you see? Some of you have had that experience, have you not? It's sort of wonderful and very disconcerting at the same time. It's great. It's lovely, actually. So when you really look at what attachment, grasping, wanting, and aversion really are, they're just movements of one's own personal will. What I want. What I don't want. And when you see through the superficial layers of the will, it will go to more deeper and hidden manifestations. All the time. I meet it all the time, you know. And there's one quality that why it can't keep you immune from it. If you have this one quality, it's like a beacon that guides you through it. If you have this one quality, and the one quality is very simple. If you really actually want to know what's real and what's true. If you have that quality, if that value is innately within you. I say innately because it's not something you decide upon. Like, yes, okay, now I will want the truth, the ultimate reality, because it'll get me something wonderful, you see, because then I'll be happy. No, 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 no. So you see, the desire, the true and authentic desire for truth, enlightenment, God, whatever you want to call it, is a completely irrational impulse. It's irrational because it's that impulse where you feel drawn towards something that the very draw itself doesn't really consider whether you like it or not. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's when you have the, I must know what the truth is, no matter what it ends up to be. If it's great, fine. If it's awful, fine. I must know. That's what I call an irrational impulse, because in that kind of impulse, it's not essentially egoically driven. Although for quite a while, we'll usually get a lot of our ego stuff mixed up in there. But if that's innately within you, that what I really want is what's really ultimately true, what's ultimately real, and for no other reason than that, So there is no ulterior motive. I don't want what's true because of what it can get me. It's because somehow it's almost like being infected with a strange bug. You see, it's a disease or something. But it's the disease of sanity, actually. You see, because sanity only feels like a disease when you're insane. So this is the real authentic spiritual impulse. I must know what's true, what's real, what's God, however you may think of it, for its own sake. This kind of, when you have this innately within you, then eventually it pulls you beyond the personal will, right? Most of us human beings are so identified to the personal will that the mere suggestion of being pulled beyond the personal will is somewhat disconcerting, if not outright offensive. Beyond the personal will, well, why would I want that? See? And I'd say, I can't imagine why. You can't want something that's outside of the personal will because it doesn't have anything to do with wanting. You see? It's that drive towards reality, it's a gift. It's literally a gift. You can't create it. You can't manufacture it. You can't pretend it. You can't phony it. I mean, you can pretend it, but you won't fool anybody but yourself. It's that it's innately there. Right? And I'm sure there are any number of people in this room that have already begun to experience in a very conscious way this diminishment of the personal will. People ask me questions about this quite, they don't put it in these terms. Nobody has come up and said, Ajay, I want to talk about the diminishment of my personal will. Although that's what's happening. They'll put it in a different way. They'll put it in a way that's a bit more personal. But it is not uncommon if you engage in a deep form of spirituality that at some point you start to notice the diminishment of your personal will. You just start to notice it. You're not drawn to the same things you were drawn to. You just, it's this, your center of motivation begins to dissipate. And as I've said, it's not uncommon for people to begin to experience this in deep spiritual work. Some amount of it, some version of it. And often it's a little disconcerting or just confusing, maybe even upsetting, but when I've had many people come and ask, talk to me and say things like, you know, Ajay, my drive to succeed, to be somebody, to be approved by people, to fit in, to all this, it's all just disappearing, and I don't know where it's all going, you see, because it's only when it starts to disappear, only then do you start to realize how your almost your whole life was actually fueled by and motivated by the personal, right? The will to achieve, to be loved, to be fit in, to, I don't know what it is. You know, it could be something really sort of obviously egoic, like the will to get even. To something very, very subtle. But it starts to dissipate. It starts to disappear. And the more awake you become, the quicker it starts to disappear. Until it starts to disappear quite rapidly. And it's only in retrospect, only in comparison, I should say, to the life you've lived, do you realize how fast that personal motivation is disappearing. Often it confuses people. I don't know why to do this anymore? Why to do that anymore? Why to do this? Why go in this direction? Why? I don't know how to make a decision anymore. You see, it's not because your mind has become like addled or something, you know. It's because when you're so used to referencing what I want, a personal viewpoint, and if that personal viewpoint starts to diminish and disappear, and you go back to try to find it, to say, yes, I have a decision. What do I want to do? And if enough of it's disappeared, you'll go back and there won't be anything there. And then you'll be confused, like, how do I make a decision? Because the thing that was always there in the center of my consciousness, meaning what I want, which makes it easier to make decisions, doesn't it? What I want. How do you make a decision? Well, based on what I want, or what's in it for me, or what's good. Do you see what I mean? When that's gone, and yet the mind still reflexively looks back, as it were, to that old reference point, and that old reference point is either gone or disappearing, it's disorienting. And that's understandable, because it's a very deep ingrown reflex. Now, of course, that particular state is a state where people can get stuck, you know? A sort of spiritual limbo zone, you know, where you get stuck in, well, in Zen they call it stuck in emptiness. That's kind of what I like to call it too, stuck in emptiness, you know. I'm not sure what to do. I'm not sure what to base how I move through life on anymore. All that personal stuff is gone, and I don't know. There's no new reference point, and people can become actually quite attached there and stuck there. It can happen. Of course, that's not the end point. The end point isn't just to get to a place where you're sitting in your living room not knowing which direction to walk in anymore. I mean, that would be silly, wouldn't it? It's very hard for people to conceive of a life that's not dominated by the personal will, what I want. Not even by a projected personal will. By projected personal will, I mean if you're an altruistic, is that right? Altruism? Altruistic, thank you. An altruistic person, that's projecting your personal will onto something bigger than yourself, right? So I want to do what God wants me to do, or what, you know, or I want the betterment of all beings. And you've kind of taken this personal will and blown it up to something bigger than yourself, universal. And that's, you know, that's very nice and spiritual and everything. But it still actually is to stay within the domain of one's will. You know, so it's not just my will. It's not altruistic. It's not for everybody else, because that's just although it's nice, you know, it's nice to be around somebody that wants you to be very happy. You know, it's kind of nice to be around them, as long as they're not too neurotic about it, you know. Do you like the china? Do you really like the... I can change it if you don't like it, you know. That's when it gets a little neurotic. But it's nice to be around people that are dedicated to the welfare of others. So if I'm going to be around people stuck in the egoic state, I want altruistic people around me who are dedicated to the welfare of others. They're much, much nicer to be around. And they create a bit less, you know, dramatic moments. And yet what I'm talking about is something beyond that, even as nice as that is. If you're going to stay in the dream state, the egoic state, it's good to be altruistic and have a bigger version than yourself. It's sort of a more healthy illusion, right? It is. It's a healthier illusion, really. And I don't mean that to diminish it. If it's a very it's an illusion the world could really do with. Do you know? It'd be very good if people had more of this altruistic illusion. But I'm even speaking about something beyond that. See, it's beyond wanting. Wanting for oneself, wanting for others. And the spiritual impulse, it'll take you there if you let it. Because what I'm speaking about isn't something that happens because you try to make it happen. That's the trajectory of the spiritual impulse is moving. It moves in that direction. So you don't have to create it. You just have to get out of the way, you see, and let it move in that way. Mostly people kick and scream as that spiritual direction, as it's moving in that direction. But ultimately, you don't have to, you can't manufacture it. Because if you tried to manufacture not my will, then you just have a will to not have my will, do you see? So it doesn't work that way. Right? I will not to have my will. No, that's still the will, you see. It's beyond that. So in a very easy conventional sense, it's the ultimate falling away, letting go or falling away. Now, like I said, you really don't have to pay much attention to what I'm talking about at all to have a good, transformative glimpse of reality. You don't have to address what I'm talking about at all to have some real deep spiritual realization. It's not necessary. But at some point, it becomes pretty much the whole of the game. Because it's this thing that I'm calling personal will. And I'm using personal will in a way that's... Like any concept, the concept is trying to point at an actual happening, an experience, an event that is much more profound than the word, the concept, personal will. And so I'm just using this as a pointer towards something. Mm-hmm. Of moving beyond wanting and not wanting, no matter what the level is of the wanting. When this starts to happen for you, especially in a deep way, you then, only then do you really realize that the whole experience of separation, to any extent, is actually, separation is dependent upon this personal will. Right? Because if it creates a sense of separation and it maintains it as well. Right? Because without this personal will, the ego can only see this and hear it in a negative way. I notice the few times that I've talked about this, I have talked about it before, but there's always the same energy field that descends upon a room. It's the same energy. There's this interested energy, but this slightly like depressive, oh shit, energy. You see, it's always the same energy. And one of the real reasons for this is because the egoic mind can only think of this in negative terms. It's very hard for the ego to put a positive spin on the diminishment of the personal will. I mean, I imagine it could because it's so darn creative, but it's relatively difficult. You know, it's easy to put a spin on, like, when you're enlightened, you'll have eternal bliss all the time. Right? The ego goes, cool, yeah, man, that's what I wanted. I like that. It's very easy. But, you know, when you talk about the diminishment of the personal will, it's very difficult for the mind to make it into something positive, which is really telling about egoic consciousness. That egoic consciousness has a very difficult time seeing that what I'm talking about as something positive, really. It's like, that really, it can sound interesting to some people, but it kind of sounds like not very much fun, you see? It's hard for the ego to spin a good story around what I'm talking about. And the reason is because it lies completely outside of the egoic domain. That's where it lies. Now, without saying it, as I said, I usually don't talk about the personable in this pointed of a way, but everything else that I've ever taught, I ever teach about, actually is informed by this very thing, the diminishment, the disappearing of one's personal will. Right down to, as many of you who've been here before know, my simple instruction about meditation, right? Allow everything to be as it is. You can't allow everything to be as it is and have your personal will working, can you? It just disengages it, right? Because everything already is the way it is, isn't it? So to say allow everything to be as it is, there's really nothing to do, is there? Even if you try to allow, you still got too much personal will. You can't even, you know, try to allow to everything to be as it is, because everything is the way that it is. And this moment is the way that this moment is. And a perfect meditation would be to perfectly allow this moment to be exactly as it is. And who wants that? Most egos go, actually, if I was honest, you see, I don't want this moment to be as it is. I want it to be as it could be. Most people want this moment to be as it could be. So for everybody who's trying to be in the moment and in the now, it sounds good, except egoically, the ego actually doesn't want anything to do with the now. That makes sense? Because if it did, it would have already hit the jackpot, because the now is already the only thing that's here, you see? Everything is the way that it is. That's the now. Do you see? So if the ego really wanted to be in the now, well, it would already have done it ages ago, wouldn't it? Because that's the only thing that's really happening. Okay. So this is actually the underlying one way of speaking about it. There's many ways to speak about everything, for better or worse, but this is the underlying thing of almost all of spirituality, whether it's meditation. It's just a relinquishing of the way I want my meditation to be. If you can relinquish the way you want your meditation to be, you'll be at peace. You won't be at peace because anything's changed. You'll be at peace because you don't want it to be other than it is. You see? Does that make sense? Somebody asked me a few weeks ago, it was like a month ago at a retreat, and someone said, well, Adya, you know, what do you do when we sit here in silence? And I said, I don't do anything. And they said, no, I mean, you know, we're meditating and everything. What do you do when you meditate? And I said, I sit there. Yes, but what do you do? I sit there. Yes, but Adya, what I would like to know is we're all sitting here too. What are you doing? And I said, well, it sounds like probably what you're doing is not sitting here, and what I'm doing is sitting here. You see? Your body is sitting there, but the rest of you isn't sitting very at all. You see what I mean? And when I'm sitting, I'm just sitting. You see? Does that make sense? So the personal will is a very tricky thing, right? Because the personal will, again, it always believes if something could be other than it is now, I'll be happy and I'll be free. And the truth is, number one, that at any moment, things can't be other than they are at that moment. They are the way they are. Like it or lump it. Your personal will has no influence upon reality. Have you all noticed that? I mean, haven't we all bumped into that like hundreds of thousands of times? You know, I want it to be like this, and it's not. And who wins, you or life? life every time. Do you see what I mean? But we don't give up, do we? We can go to our graves, 70, 80, 90 years old. If it just was this way in my last dying breath, I would be happy. You see, and you think some God's going to come and save you, and actually God's already tried to save you. God's like, it is the way it is. And if you just accepted it, you'd be totally happy. You know? Oh. Have you ever met somebody dying that's discovered this? Oftentimes people, you don't have to, but oftentimes people discover what I'm speaking about. They begin to discover it at very trying times when they realize that when it hits them, that they have no other option than right now. And sometimes when someone is in the process of dying and that hits them, finally, that they're going to die, that there's no out, that there's not going to be, they're not going to be the first person in the history of humanity that's actually going to do a roundabout around death. When they realize this is happening and they finally allow it to happen. You ever been around someone like that? It's amazing, is it not? They've let go of their personal will because it's come up against a force that they know is they're not going to be able to negotiate with it. It's a bigger force than their will. It's called death, right? But there's also a force that's bigger than your personal will, and it's called life. It's the same force. Life and death are the same force. Neither of them conform. Which is why egos are always kind of vacillating between being happy now and then upset then. Happy, I'm happy when things go, they happen to go the way I want them to go. Right? Happy. And if it doesn't go the way I want it to go, not happy. And egos sort of vacillate from one to the other. So a lot of people, the first time they experienced life beyond the personal will is in a very, very trying circumstance. Now, people can be in extraordinarily trying circumstances and still never let go. In fact, overwhelmingly, most people don't, even then. But those who do, if you've ever seen, there's a great peace within them. Even as their biological life is coming to an end, there's an extraordinary, extraordinary peace. And here they are experiencing the thing that almost everybody dreads. You know, they're dying. Why are they at such amazing peace? And of course, the answer is very simple. They've let go of their personal will. They've joined with reality. The reality is their body's dying. They've joined with it. And then they discovered, oh, real happiness doesn't come from acquiring what I want. Real happiness comes just from joining, coming into union with, coming into identification with, identity with reality. And who would have thought that? You see, just by coming into union with reality. Right here and right now, there would be a great peace. As it says in the Bible, you know, the peace that surpasses all understanding. Because there is a peace that's very understandable. The understandable peace is you're at peace because everything's going well. You're at peace. It's understandable. There's a peace that's, but the peace that's beyond understanding is what I'm speaking about. It's a peace that's not conditional. The only condition it has is, are you in absolute union with reality, with what is? Outside of that, there's no condition. No other conditions need to be met than you're in union with what is. So whether that's at a very sort of coarse, egoic level of really wanting, really not wanting, not only in the moment, but in the past too, right? What the way I wish things were, but they'll never be the way you wish they were, will they? You'll never be the way you wished you were. And there's no altering it. It's unavoidably the way it was, right? You don't change something that's already gone and dead. It's unalterable. Ego says, I can't be happy then. You see, because how it was not how it was supposed to be, so I can't be happy. But and that's a real dilemma, isn't it? Because what was can never change, can it? Never. Puts the ego in a dilemma. And I can't just allow what was to be what was. Why not? Well, I don't know, but I can't. You see? It would be so unfair. You see? Does that make sense? So whether it's a sort of very coarse level like that, or it's very subtle, very, very subtle, when you really start to look at it, spiritual realization is really ultimately all about this transcending of the diminishment of the personal will. Spiritual realization, a moment of awakening, a moment of aha, of seeing everything as it is, an enlightenment moment, that's valuable to the extent that it engenders a letting go of the personal will. That moment in and of itself will not be sufficient if it has not engendered a deeper, much, much deeper letting go. Because it's ultimately the letting go that's important. That's what's important. If there's not letting go, then that moment will become, as my teacher used to say, like a dream you once had. So as a great Zen master had said, he said the most important thing, Dogen had said, this ancient Zen master, he said the most important thing is the way-seeking mind. The way meant the truth, ultimate reality. The way-seeking mind, the truth, wanting what's real, what's true. To have that inherent within you. Whether it's good for you egoically or not, whether there's something in it for you or not, something that the desire from right at the beginning has to have a quality. It's not that it has to be exclusively, because everybody wants, would prefer pleasure over distress, wouldn't you? So it's not like you got to get rid of the pleasure principle. You're not going to get rid of that. It's fine to want pleasurable experiences and not want unpleasurable experiences to a certain extent, right? If you didn't have that, like if it was freezing cold, you just stay out there and freeze. It's a nice biological necessity that you have at least enough desire to go, you know, I would rather not freeze and go into that nice church room there where I can sit there and get warmed up. But you actually don't need much more than that. You see, the rest is just sort of useless. So when you view spirituality or begin to view it through this particular lens, I think it makes certain things much clearer. You know, whether it's whatever sort of spiritual practice you're doing, whether it's the dialogues that we have in here, the quality of the dialogues we have, what questions that you view are really essential to your own awakening. You see. To really look and see, you know, is this, have I made my spirituality into simply the pursuit of pleasure, even if that's called enlightenment? Or, if I really look deeply, is there actually a deeper impulse going on? Is there something that's, even though everybody wants pleasurable experiences, is there already from the very beginning something deeper than that? Something that you didn't create, something that's just sort of innately there, right? That desire, that wanting, that, or simply the valuing of the real, right? Whatever you word you use for the real, for reality, doesn't matter. Reality, the divine, God, truth, whatever it is. But that you feel something drawing you in that direction, even though you don't know where it will end up. And that pull and that draw is transcendent of your personal concern. You know? It gives a whole new orientation to your spirituality. A much more powerful and potent orientation too, I might add. So, let's see what's on your mind. Come on up. I'll work my way back. I'll get back to you next, okay? All right. Good deal. And by the way, if you've ever really noticed, wherever you have a real spiritual breakthrough of any kind, it almost always catches you by surprise. And why does it catch you by surprise? Because it's usually in one of those moments where your personal will forgot to be overactive. Do you know? It's absolutely not predictable, but it's absolutely classic. You might be struggling, and even in a moment of exhaustion, boom, light's gone. Whoa, what was I doing? You see? And the truth was, for a moment, for a split instant, you weren't doing. Your personal will took a break. That's all that was needed for reality to come in. Or it could be just something more mature. You just see the futility of it. You see that grasping and pushing away isn't what you're called for, and it just naturally falls away, and then the veil parts. Good afternoon.
Hi, Ajahn.
Hi.
I'm not so sure that this is a question as much as a kind of a musing on this same subject.
Okay.
And it seems that I've heard you talk about closing the gap.
Yes.
Many times.
Yes.
And also just this idea of the personal will dissipating. Mm-hmm. Or even noticing something like that happening. I sense that you've talked about, well, with that happening, then there's more movement, therefore, capable. The spirit is more able to move through.
Absolutely.
In that, and take over, therefore. So you will be moved. It might not be called will at that point.
Yeah, that it's hard to say you're moved by the whole.
Instead of a personal will.
Yes.
So then even the ego could actually relax a little bit about that, knowing that it's going to be moved by something bigger than
it
is.
It can relax completely.
Yes.
Yeah. Because it's not like, as I said, it's not like you end up, you know, in the middle of your living room not knowing which way to turn. You know, you might be like that for a while, actually, but that's not ultimately the end point. The end point is actually, as on your human aspect, your human part, it's moved by the whole, mm-hmm. instead of motivated by the part. You know, it's moved by, so it's a movement of wholeness, and the movement of wholeness, it doesn't know separation. The divine spirit doesn't know separation, so it wouldn't even know how to address separation. All it knows is wholeness. That's all it knows, because that's all it is. And so that moves, and it's actually much more. See, I hesitate to put the positive connotations on it, even though To be honest, there are positive connotations to it, because it's absolutely delightful to be, for the whole, to not be having to sort of keep being distorted by the personal will, for it to just act, the whole, or you could call it spirit, for it just to be moving without being impeded all the time. It's lovely. You know, but I hesitate to give it too much spirit or positive connotations, because then the mind, the egoic will goes, ooh, I'd like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You see, and then it gets attached to the good part. But of course it is, it's, one feels it, right? When this wholeness is just moving and operating very spontaneously.
So would you, this is something that you've called closing the gap?
Yeah. Well, the movement itself is when the gap is closed, mm-hmm. where there is no gap between what's realized and who we are as a human being. Right, that gap gets closed, because often when we have a realization of spiritual awakening, at some point we start to recognize very often that there's a gap between what we know, what we've realized, and where our activity is coming from, where our human movement is coming from, right? There's often this great discrepancy. Like, I know that that's not true, what I'm saying, what I'm doing. I know it's not coming from, it's not an expression of truth, but good Lord, it's happening anyway. That's the gap. Mm-hmm. And I pass along what my teacher used to say, close the gap. You see, but the ego can't close the gap. It doesn't know the first thing about closing the gap. You can't close that gap by trying to close the gap. Mm-hmm. The gap closes by itself when you see what's creating the gap. What's creating the gap is always very simple, although its expression may be quite varied. It's always some version of what I want, what I don't want. That creates the gap. Or as one old Zen master said, one thought sets heaven and earth infinitely apart. I would add one thought believed. You know, just the passing of a thought, no problem. The believing of a thought, big problem.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah. Yeah. It's, the thing about all this, it's hard to really enunciate, it's hard to really get across, is the more subtle version, where the more subtle movement of this sort of dropping away of the personal will is in many ways the most powerful, even though it's very, very, it's experienced as something quite subtle. And that's the hardest thing to get across, is You start to run up against almost these archetypal patterns of holding. You know, almost like a very common one that some people, it depends on what your makeup is, but people come up almost, at some point, you almost feel this existential sort of hesitation or guilt, like, I can't just totally let go, you see, because then I would be leaving behind, in many ways, the human condition. And I'd be leaving everybody in it behind. My loved ones, my mate, my children, my everybody, I'm going to be, and I don't mean you're going to be leaving them behind as a human being. Of course, you're going to still be standing there just like you were before. But internally, when you realize you're leaving behind, and there's this archetypal, for a lot of people, sort of pull, that it's like a taboo. It's an archetypal taboo that's kind of like, no, you can't do that. You can visit there, but you can't live there, you see. You can't just go. You can't leave us all behind. It's not fair. You have this duty. I'm just giving words to this sort of, this deep archetype within human consciousness. It's like a taboo against fully being what you really are. You bump in, often people will bump into that. This is something on a bit more subtle level. There are other sort of deep, what I think of as almost archetypal patterns, because they're so common, and yet they're quite subtle, that when you run up against them, you're actually quite surprised. These seemingly really good arguments why you can't fully let go. You know, like, yeah, but we're destroying everything. You see, we're destroying the earth and we're killing each other and there's starving babies all over the world. And you can't just totally let go. You see? Seems like a good argument, huh? You can't just let go and let them all die and starve. And of course, that's not what's being asked for. You're not being asked to just let them starve and die and fend for themselves. What you're being asked for is to let go. The outcome of that is completely unknown. You can't know what you will be doing once you've let go. And that's the hard part for the mind. The mind wants to know, yeah, I can let go into this place beyond my personal will if I just knew what it would be like. The problem is you can't know what it will be like until you're already there. You see what I mean? So again, the only thing you have to rely on is this irrational impulse, which is this impulse that's deeper than something that's you-centered or even us-centered. It's deeper than that. You pulled to it for reasons that you don't know. In retrospect, you look back and go, why did I ever hesitate for 1 second? Why did I ever think that me staying in the egoic consciousness was somehow going to help humanity? Why did I even hesitate for a split second? But that's in 2020 hindsight. When you're there feeling the tug of the archetype against being what you fully are completely, it doesn't seem that obvious at all. There seems to be really good reasons why you shouldn't let go, right? And if good reasons don't work to get you to hold on, then you'll get spooked. Spooky reasons. This terrible thing will happen. The devil will take you over, right? Like Jesus when he spent his 40 days in the desert, you know, and he gets tempted and did it, right? Temptation, this is what's in it for you, kid. Here, come over here. This is what you can become. I'll give you everything you want. Temptation, when that doesn't work, fear. Come over here or else. Something terrible is going to happen to you. So these stories are there because people have experienced this sort of very, very deep movement. And they've had to, what you encounter is very archetypal, very classic in many ways. Hi.
I was wondering if you could comment a little more on what helps when one finds themselves in spiritual limbo or stuck in that emptiness that you referenced.
Tell me your experience of being stuck in it. In some way.
Yeah,
As good as you can.
It's hard to talk about without going into too much detail, but...
I know.
Over the last 5 months, I've found myself in a... going through, I guess, what some may call kind of somewhat of a kundalini awakening. And I find often that I get stuck, very stuck, in certain states of being throughout that process.
Oh, yes. And pleasurable states of being?
The whole spectrum.
Yeah.
Yeah. But often pleasurable. Yeah. And when you had mentioned that state of stuck in the emptiness, that just really kind of resonated with me.
Yeah.
And I often kind of find myself feeling stuck in that state, like there's these blinders on almost.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of incapable of stepping back and having any perspective. It can be a beautiful state to be in, but...
Right.
And I can also be hanging from a thread, too, and
right.
on the polar opposite. And so I was wondering what you felt helped when stuck in that place.
Noticing your fascination with it. Because that's why we get stuck almost anywhere we get stuck, is because whether it's very, very pleasant or not so pleasant, there's always some degree of fascination. Just being fascinated. Not in an obvious way, sometimes in an obvious way, but in a not so obvious way. Just being fascinated. I know that sounds very simplistic, but it's sort of an underlying part of what causes us to sort of get stuck somewhere, because actually we're fascinated with being stuck there, right?
Yes.
Like people can be in a very, very negative state and be stuck, but they actually have some sort of a comfort. It's, it can be familiar, or it can be very, very pleasurable. And of course, to get stuck in a pleasurable state, I think that's easier to understand how one would be fascinated with that.
Yeah.
So it's not a technique kind of thing. It's like, what do I do to kind of get myself out of that stuckness? It's just starting to see the answer to anything is to be more conscious. It's not so how much what do I do, is what brings more consciousness. So as you see, oh, this stuckness is because I'm kind of fascinated with this state or that state. And when you see you're fascinated with it, you've brought more consciousness to it. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
When that fascination disappears, you'll move beyond it or it'll fall away, mm-hmm. however you want to think about it.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
And in your intuition, like, you know, this there may be something very pleasant. And you may even get very useful insights at times. So it can have a very positive influence. But ultimately, when you feel this sense, there is this guiding, inner guidance, I guess I'd say, that knows, like, this, keep moving. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
This might be very valuable. There might be very something beautiful you've seen here. There might be, okay, now it's time to keep moving. And a lot of times we'll say, well, okay, where do I go?
Yeah.
But it's not so much like where you go, it's seeing what's holding you there.
Mm.
And usually it's some sort of positive or negative type of fascination. When you see that, you'll notice it just starts to fall away on its own.
So stay curious and keep...
Yeah.
Keep the awareness.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Or it could be also that there can be, I'm just throwing a few things out
there.
So it can sometimes be also based in fear. Like people can be stuck in negative, what I call negative emptiness. There's positive emptiness,
uh-huh.
which is sort of like a total bliss of being, of realizing that you're nothing. Then there's the negative stuck in emptiness, which is sort of a complete lack, it's sort of like inertia, complete lack of being able to motivate yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that can all, you can, often people see they're actually fascinated with that because there's a certain comfort in that,
mm-hmm.
right? Because not to be engaged has a certain comfort to it. And to become engaged again can feel threatening or frightening. Does that make sense? It's very common, especially with the spiritual personalities. Spiritual personalities are as afraid of life as they are of death, and frequently more, you know? So all these are different ways of being very subtly or overtly fascinated with where we are. You see what I mean? As one old wise Zen master said, many, many years ago, he said, abide in non-abiding.
I'll think about that.
Yeah. Not too much, just do it.
Okay.
You got to watch yourself with that Zen stuff.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It makes sense in the instant that it goes into your consciousness.
Mm.
And if for a split instant, and then you start to think about it, and your mind can't make sense of it.
That's often when some of these states shift for me, is when I start thinking about them, I'll lose them.
Yeah.
And it's...
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
You start to conceptualize them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's, of course, the mind is a mechanism that loves to know, right? And that's not a bad thing. It's a good thing that your mind likes to know. It's what helps you to survive, right? That our mind likes to know how to do things. But... Our mind also has to know when it comes to its limitation. When the mind comes up to something that it can't actually know through thinking.
Mm.
You can know how to build this building through thinking. Thinking can tell you how to build this building or how to build this microphone. But thought, there are things that thought can't actually tell you about. The ultimate reality is beyond thought. Mm-hmm. So you can't, you can experience it, but then your mind's going to want to try to make it into thought. And if it does, then what you'll find is you'll be pulled, consciousness will be pulled back into thought.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Rather than the actual experience is self-evident, and it's self-evidently beyond thinking mind.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The more of reality you experience, the less you know.
Mm.
The more, or I say, the more you know that you don't know in your head, in your
mm-hmm.
mind,
mm-hmm.
but the more you know in your being.
Because
we do have an intelligence that belongs to our entire being. There's an intelligence that belongs to our brain function, and then there's an intelligence that belongs to our entire being. That intelligence that belongs to your being can, in its own way, comprehend, for lack of a better word, the ultimate. This thing can't.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let me know how it goes. All right? Okay. Yes. How late do we go till? Anybody know? 5:45. Thank you. I've completely lost track of time.
Hi, Adya.
Nice to see you again.
Since yesterday, so there's been us. I'm just not sure how to navigate this.
Yeah.
So, for example, yesterday in the morning, I was sitting.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess I've mentioned it before, the energy movements have been intense from last 1 year. And per your advice, I haven't really paid attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
I've just let it be.
Yeah.
And yesterday I was sitting, and I was aware the energy was moving through, and I just let it be. And I saw something about what's holding me back. I had a question when I sat down, and I saw some identifications I still had.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, something happened. There was a blast of or a bolt of energy that was more intense than I'm used to.
Yeah.
So what happened is I just experienced this kind of like explosion, and I was like, I remember feeling a little bit, I was like reeling at first. I was like,
mm-hmm.
wow. And and I remember the chest expanding and the heart expanding more than usual.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow I lost awareness of it. It was really intense and forceful, and I was just that, the
yeah.
energy. So what happened next is where I would probably need some help. I lost, there was no awareness of the body.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long that was, and I noticed my body was cold and limp.
Yeah.
So my limbs were like twisted out, like lifeless. They looked really unusual, and
mm-hmm.
I remember looking at it and going, how would I even like bring them back? You know, there was just this.
Yeah.
No. So, and then there was a, and, but the whole time while this is happening, I felt like the whole body was growing cold. I had a thought that I could stop breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't know where I was breathing from there was no awareness of the breath. I was just not anywhere here.
Right. No body awareness at all.
No body awareness.
Yeah.
So that's when I panicked.
Ah.
I was like, oh, so I could stop breathing, and this could be a stupid way to leave. you know, just because I had some explosion and I forgot to breathe, and then my body just goes, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have fear of, like, physical death anymore, yeah. But still I thought it wasn't very sensible to live like this.
Yeah, like, no, what a way to go.
Yeah.
Huh? Why did you die? Because I forgot to breathe. Yeah.
So when I guess I was panicking, and the more I started breathing, like, you know, I was gasping for breath, mm-hmm. My body went into a deeper state of limpness or shock where I couldn't move. And fortunately, my boyfriend came running out of the house because he noticed me through the window that I was gasping.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me probably 3 or 5 minutes before I felt my own physical body again.
Yeah.
And I was shaking like a leaf after that for a long, long time. Like
I'd
been, yeah. So that scared me a little bit.
Like, I was going to say, you really spooked yourself.
Yeah, I was like, whoa, so what do I do with this? And then I visited a good friend of mine, Prima, because I was like wanting to not be scared of this, wanted some comfort and some...
Of course.
Someone who was love. And I did the same thing. I went into meditation, and it's always there.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, I mean, since yesterday, it's been really intense where it just takes over me.
Yeah.
The exact same thing happened in the afternoon too, where my whole body went limp and cold.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, but the second time around though, there was more... because I'd done it once before, I knew I wasn't going to die. I could still breathe.
Right.
So that was good. And today, this morning, I was like kind of dreading sitting down.
Yeah, you don't know if you're just
like,
gonna...
whoa. And this today, I was more able to like remember to breathe, and I didn't lose awareness, though it was there, ready mm-hmm. to. So my question to you is, bringing my awareness back to the body, it seems like it's also not right. It may not also be the right thing to do. Like I feel like I'm not surrendering completely.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, so if the body dies, okay, it should die, but I'm not sure I'm supposed to die this way.
Yeah, first of all, it's not going to die.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Your body's not stupid. So all the time that you weren't aware of it, before you started to think, because the fear came when you started to think, oh, I could stop breathing. I could stop my heart beating.
Yeah.
Right? But up till that time, you really didn't have any, as you said, you didn't have any sense of the body at all, and yet it was doing absolutely fine. How do we know that? Because here it is.
Yeah.
It didn't stop breathing. The heart didn't stop beating. It actually was doing just fine, even though you or your thoughts had no awareness of it whatsoever.
I felt great afterwards, too.
Of course.
No damage or anything.
Yes. Actually, it's quite the opposite of my body might perish. It's actually the absolutely best thing you could do for your body. That's why you feel so great when you come out of that state.
So the
extraordinarily regenerating.
So the limpness, the coldness, is that okay?
That is indicative of a particular state of deep samadhi. You lose consciousness of your body in a particular state, right? Then your body actually gets a certain coldness around it. It's also classic, right? And then deeper than that, then you even lose consciousness of thought. And all that's the best thing I can tell you is as strange as it feels when it's happening to you, especially when it's new, it's actually everything you've described is very classic in a sense. All the symptoms are absolutely classic. The coldness of the body, the losing the sense of the body completely, classic for you sit down and meditate and you enter this spontaneously, this very deep state of samadhi. And everything knows what it's doing. So your system's not going to stop breathing. It's not going to kill you. It's not any more than going to bed at night kills you. When you go to sleep at night, you lose sense of body and you lose sense of all that. And you actually regenerate through the night to a great degree. Right? This is just kind of, in a sense, it's going through the same process, except there's an awareness with it. The awareness is still there.
So I could just be and not worry. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. You can just be. Right? Yeah. And everything will be totally, absolutely fine. Yeah. And everything you mentioned is very, as I said, very sort of classic. Even down to the weird hand positions and things that can happen. Right, because when you completely lose consciousness of the body, then there's no controlling mechanism in the body, right? So the body just kind of does its own thing. It's what happens when there's absolutely no controlling mechanism in the body. Yeah. And your body will take the shape of when there's no controlling mechanism. It might be subtle, it might be your hands, sometimes it's people's whole bodies, you never know. You see?
Thank you.
All right. Yeah. It's I would encourage sort of that it's, you can either go the way our minds do, because even in that state, it's amazing that the mind could come and coherently think, right? It's almost amazing that you could actually form a coherent thought in that state, because it's not easy to form a coherent thought when you get into that deepest state. But that your mind can actually come in and scare you with one thought, huh? I could stop breathing. And it's the thought that scared you, not what was happening, right? Because that's the quality of mind. The mind thinks, if I'm not here, everything might just fall apart. I might stop breathing, the body might die, you see? Now we're talking about this will in its most infinitesimally subtle manifestation. Just that movement of thought. If I wasn't here to watch over this, I might never have taken another breath. And it's just that thought. But that's all it is. It's just a thought. You've heard the phrase die before you die. Yeah, you were doing a pretty good job of it there. You see what I mean? Body can go. Yes. Hi.
Okay, so I was sitting there confused. Until I heard this story. And that was great for my personal will, because it just now says, okay, so that's where we have to get to.
Oh, wouldn't
if that? We're getting there.
Ah.
Right?
And if yeah, that's a good trick.
So let's, if you have to have an experience like that.
Yeah.
So then there's a part of me that says, well, that's just the, I mean, there's jealousy. Right? And yeah. Anger. And then there's a part of me that says,
I want to be scared to death too.
No.
No,
there's a part of me that says, that's just out of the body experience. That's not awakening. Right? So then all these parts of me are just
right.
Fighting.
One thought against another thought. when you come down to the bottom of it, the mind really doesn't know what it's talking about, does it? Like, it doesn't know if you have to have that. It doesn't know if it's significant. It doesn't know if it's not significant. It really doesn't know what to make out of it. If it could stay in that knowledge, because that's just basic honesty, right? That's what your mind knows. I really don't know all this stuff. But our minds usually don't stay in that kind of, that state of humility. They go, well, I don't know, but boy, I can spin a story. Right?
So that's how I would recognize. Because it.
How you what?
That's how it would recognize. Mm-hmm. Because it looks for an experience constantly.
That's right. That's right.
And it doesn't matter how many of them.
Right.
It's never that one.
Right. See, the mind doesn't know what it's talking about. And it's not personal. It's not just your mind.
No, it doesn't know what it's talking about. Well, it always knows what it's talking about.
It thinks it does.
Well, yes. And yeah. Then it tells itself, you don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
Right.
And then it feels bad about it.
I mean, it just, that's where that craziness and confusion
comes.
Yeah,
that's right.
And then it also knows, and then it doesn't know, and then it knows, and it doesn't know. And then, yeah.
I think the most useful thing is to a large degree, again, there's a place and a time and a usefulness of mind and thought. But in this particular sense, that the mind, thought, really doesn't know anything about this domain.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand our mind, you know, does, it plays whatever scenario it plays out, even with that piece of information.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. One of the most wonderful things you can realize is whatever's going on up here, the whole play of mind, is actually irrelevant. It's just irrelevant, which doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it's not relevant. As long as we think that this might be relevant, what's going on, then we stay in the domain of the thinking mind. Because the thinking mind always thinks that it is relevant or it will become relevant.
So then it says, since you're not the one who's doing it, so the personal will has no relevance.
No.
So it hasn't been doing it, right?
Personal will hasn't been doing a darn thing except
trying
to do it.
So why get
everything.
Rid of it? Or not get rid of it or even talk about it?
You see, again, it's all that plays, that's all playing out on the level of mind.
Yeah.
See what I mean? Because this stuff doesn't make sense on the level of mind. Right? If personal will doesn't actually dictate anything and it doesn't actually influence anything, then why get rid of it? Why would get rid of something that isn't actually there? It doesn't make sense on the level of mind. Well, any more than it makes sense that everybody is already inherently enlightened. So why are we doing all this? The answer is simple, because a fat lot of good it does you if you don't know that you're, that's what you are, you see?
But it never knew, but it never believed it was doing it to start with. It that's where fakeness comes.
So what's the real point here?
I don't know, Arya.
I know.
Just arguing?
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I asked the question. Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. And even that's okay.
Yeah, until it's not.
Mm-hmm. And even then, it's okay.
And right there, I mean, well, see, I know more than you do.
Much more.
I know.
Yes.
And then I still come here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Minds know a lot. Well, that's the whole danger of this, because the mind can listen, it can hear, it can understand, it can actually start to understand all this. You think, wait, I understand all this. Why hasn't that totally helped me? I understand all this. I've had people say, you know, people tell me they have conversations with their head. They have conversations with me in their head, and they can predict seemingly with great accuracy what I'll probably say. And I have no doubt that people hang around long enough, and they probably can predict probably what I'll say to a pretty close degree. And yet what you find after a while is it doesn't actually help either. Because, you know, if we getting this on the level of mind, it can be helpful, but it's only helpful if it allows the mind to relax. If it allows the mind to relax, then consciousness can come out of the domain of mind. If it causes the mind to kind of come in on itself, like, I know all the answers to the questions, I know this, then it actually has the opposite effect. And I believe, it seems like to me, most of the people have probably had both of those kind of experiences happen, right? Where the mind relaxes, oh, I know, and yet what good has that done me? And the opposite, gosh, and the grasping from knowing too much, you know? As another Zen master once said, to know and not to be is not yet to know. You know? And when we're being, curiously enough, we don't know so much. We don't know. Does that make sense? You don't know. At the moment you're being, your mind doesn't know. The simplest things. What's it like to close your fist? Do it without a thought in your head, you know. You know what it's like. Now try to know in your mind. What's it like to close your... You don't really know. The only way you can know is by closing it. And that is a knowledge that you know what it's like, even if you have no thought in your head at all. You know, because you're being it. You're being it. If you're not being something, then you don't know something. You're removed from it. Yeah. As I heard a scientist say just about a week ago on a TV program, he said, you know, he was a particle physicist. And he said, you know, I'm a particle physicist, and one thing that you come to know by being a physicist is that physics doesn't actually tell you what anything is. It tells you how things tend to behave. But what it shows you is you don't actually know what anything is, but it teaches you how to predict the behavior of what you see or find the laws along which it operates. But the suchness of what it is, it doesn't tell you that. It can't reach that. Do you know? Because it's sort of an infinitely regressive question. What is this? Well, it's this. And what's that? Well, that is this. And what's that? Well, that is this. And what's that? That is this. And it just goes in circles, you know? So the true knowledge of something is the being of it. You got to be it to know it. Okay. That's a good place to stop, huh? Very nice to be with you today. Very nice to be with you today. Namaste. Namaste. Enjoy yourselves.